IAAF World Athletics Championships, our podcast Inside Lane with myself, Mike Finch, and Dr. Russ Tucker, the athletics analyst, according to the Guardian newspaper. And big thanks to the Guardian for putting a tag through for our podcast on one of their stories they did yesterday. The story, of course, that's been doing the rounds is, in fact, it was on the front page of the newspapers here in South Africa today, was Wade van Niekerk's reaction to the conspiracy theory around Isaac Mokwala. And if you haven't heard about that, obviously that's been doing the rounds this week. Michael Johnson, the great 400-meter runner, suggesting that the IAAF's reluctance to let Mokwala race in the 200 and the 400 metres, particularly the 400 metres, was about giving Wade van Niekerk the best chance of getting a double gold. We've already rubbished that idea. We've decided that Michael Johnson's tweets yesterday were pretty... in fact, not yesterday. I think it was actually on Tuesday and Wednesday that he tweeted the idea that there was some kind of conspiracy theory. Has really been not his best work. I think he was a better runner than he is a social commentator, but we'll go with that. But anyway, I'm not going to focus too much on that today. It has been one of the big stories of the World Championships. On Monday, Ross and I will be taking you through a sort of a highlight of the entire World Championships. So let us know what you think about what has been the highlights. You know, what have been the controversies? What have been the lessons you've learned from these championships? We'd love to know what you feel. And we'll sort of take a bit of a stab at it on Monday as well to give an idea of what the future of athletics lies and how it lies in the next couple of years. But for now, let's look at the highlights of last night. So the big news is it's a bit like dog bites man, because we're going to say this, and if you didn't watch last night, you're going to be surprised. A Kenyan didn't win the women's steeplechase. And that is a story in itself, Ross.
Yes. The women's steeplechase, being as new as it is, often has been won by, well, it's been Jebet, who is Kenyan, running for Bahrain and so forth. And there was a Russian winner at one point, I think, when it first debuted, because it was only in 2008 in the Olympic Games that women were first able to do the steeplechase. So we said yesterday it's an event that's now leaving puberty and it's into adolescence, and that's when interesting things happen. And last night was absolutely nuts. I've never seen someone do what Chepkoech did. If you didn't see it, you need to find.
She was the favorite. Beatrice Chepkoech was the favorite.
It was difficult to find a favorite out of the four Kenyan-born athletes, none of whom won it. So they were the four that everyone's thinking, okay, they're going to be very difficult to beat at these world champs. But by virtue of winning a race where all four of them were competing a few weeks back in Paris, Chepkoech would have been the favorite. But within 400 meters of the start, she made life difficult because she ran straight past the water jump. Everyone veered left, and Chepkoech. And I watched it again, and there was a bit of jostling going on, and I don't know whether she was just in the moment so much with the jostling and so forth that she just went straight. And she snaps out of it only when she's literally next to the other runners splashing about in the swimming pool. So she does a double take, almost turns around on a sixpence type thing, goes back around and jumps. She must have lost 7-8 seconds. Now she's panicking, but she's catching up. And then on the third hurdle after that, she falls. So it's like a cartoon of everything going wrong that could go wrong. But
and I guess at that level, once you have to put in that sort of surge just to get back into the race, it takes a lot out of you. And in fact, that's the difference maybe from her potentially have won the race versus finishing down the field.
Yeah, because the pace wasn't slow. At that point, the two Bahraini athletes had gone to the front, and perhaps realizing what had happened, Jebet then pushes it on. And they did 3:02 for the first kilometer, I think it was. And so she was working hard to catch up on a fast pace. How much does that cost her? I mean, she's run 10 seconds faster than everyone else within the first 4 minutes of the race. That's costly. So certainly she ended up fourth.
Yeah.
You got to think she's a medalist.
Yeah.
Without that.
Yeah.
But meanwhile up front, nothing's going to script either. It was completely bananas.
What are you talking? I'm actually just going to adjust the camera. If you're watching us live on Facebook Live, you'll notice that Ross's head has been cut off. So we're just going to adjust that. Just go through that last room while I adjust the picture for us.
So Jebet does all the work, which is exactly what she's done in 2016. And in 2016, it came off for her because she would go to the front. She'd make the pace harder than anyone else could follow. And that would win her gold medals and set world records eventually, even after the Olympics. yesterday it didn't work, and she found herself again, because the event is a little stronger and everyone has responded to the level of performance needed, she finds herself with company and she ran out of steam. So I think two things are, one is Jebet's not at the same level she was at, and everyone else has just closed that gap a little bit more. It looked at times that the two Americans were being stretched. It's hard to know. I mean, maybe Coburn was comfortable and she wants some space for the jumps. That happens. But with one lap to go, there were enough of them in contention. Jebet by that stage was gone. I was reading this morning, Coburn said many times, said yesterday that she, the whole way on that last lap, she was waiting for the Kenyans to come past her.
And they didn't.
And they didn't.
Yeah.
And then technically she's the best of them. So going into the last water jump, her hurdling technique now is worth 2 meters. Maybe less, maybe 1.5 meters. But that's all it takes. Two jumps, gold medal. So nuts. And then in second, it's not a Kenyan.
Yeah.
It's another American who's running 15 seconds faster than she ever has in her life, which is which is absolutely
well, that was Courtney Ferrix, who probably did the best celebration, I think, of the world champs. I don't think we've seen anybody celebrate quite like she did. I mean, she was emotional. I don't think she could believe it. As she crossed that line and saw that they finished first and second, she was awash with emotion, hugging, and they were lying on the ground there in this sort of sea of emotion, Anchorman style. You know, just quite amazing to see. And it shows you the where people's perception, even at that level, are. Beating the Kenyans is something quite special, an event which they traditionally are known to dominate.
Yeah. If you're standing on the start line and you're a 9:19 athlete, which is her best going in, and you know that there are four women at 9, and even your teammates 9:07, you're always optimistic, I think, as an elite athlete, but you can't seriously be thinking, I'm going to hang on and run 9:04, 9:05. Talk about shock.
But there's no, I mean, I guess what one of the interesting things about that is that there's always talk about whether you should run from the front if you're a certain kind of runner, or whether you should be following somebody from behind. Clearly, in the case of the Americans, they followed the Kenyan lead most of the time. But once they were in the front, it kind of psychologically gave them a boost that they were actually ahead of what they perceived as the favorites.
Yeah, I think you hear the bell and you're there. So now it's...
Yeah.
Forget about vests and nationals and histories and past. Like, you're there with 400 to go. You've done enough to put yourself in with a chance. But that race was always going to go the way that it did, with one of those four being aggressive, and it was Jebet. And it was always going to go with Coburn hanging on for as long as possible and perhaps picking up the pieces from athletes falling off. That's how I think most people thought Coburn might medal. But no one would have, well, not no one, but very few would have said she's winning it.
Yeah.
And like, if you'd said 1-2 for America, no way. Yeah. That was crazy. And plus then all the plot twists. Now you've got athletes missing water jumps and having and falling. It was crazy.
Yeah. I'm sure you could YouTube that or find it somewhere on some of the platforms available, because it is worth watching again. And it's definitely one of the more interesting events you've seen. And we predicted it yesterday. It was an open event. Because it's relatively new, the times are always relatively fast based on world best. I think it was the 7th fastest ever time in the steeplechase, something like that, which sounds amazing. But when you think about how young the event is, it's still good, but it's not the same level as maybe a men's 3,000 steeplechase.
Yeah, absolutely.
Second event, so the second final was the women's 200 meters. Obviously, the talk was about Shanae Milot-Weibo, who in the 400 meters, if most of you watched that, you'll see her pulling up in the last 30 meters with a clear lead. There was always going to be a question mark. She was up against Daphne Skippers, the Dutch athlete, the defending world champion. It turned out to be a race which went well for Skippers, but a fantastic performance from Weibo, despite all these problems she's had this week.
Yeah, so that one we said in our preview, the medals were going to three athletes. And it wasn't a clear thing in the end, because from third to fourth was closer than perhaps I thought it would be. But it was clearly, from the semis, it was Skippers to Lou Miller. They were the separate class apart in that race. And the question for Miller, if we want to give her view of the race, is how close could she be with 80 to go? Because she's going to finish it faster. But unfortunately for her,
why is she going to finish it faster compared to Skippers and Toulouse?
Yeah, so 200 meters is not it's a flat out sprint, but it's not. Because you're going to have declining speed in the last 50 meters. Everyone is slowing down.
Nobody speeds up.
No one's speeding up in the last 50 meters. It's a test of fatigue tolerance, basically. And because you are competing at such a high intensity, and it's for biochemical reasons, what's happening in the muscles is that they're generating energy, but a byproduct of that energy production is all sorts of metabolic metabolites is what they're called, hydrogen ions, phosphates, calcium, and those are causing you to basically lose power and lose force in the muscles. And
so that's why, so much like a sort of obviously less than the 400 meters, but the same doesn't happen in the 100 because it's too short. Is that right?
They also slow down from 60 meters onwards.
Okay. For the same reason.
Yes, for the same reason is that the muscle is just unable to, the factories inside the muscle are just unable to produce the energy at the rate required, and so you see that decline. So the shape is the same in all these events. You do your fastest running in the, obviously you're starting out the blocks, so you're going to be slower.
Mm.
Your fastest running comes in the second quarter, so it's in the third quarter, around that bend into the home straight, and then you're fighting against slowing down.
Mm.
The 400 meter runner has the machinery, the muscle factory, to resist that fatigue a little bit better. They're more conditioned for that. So they tend to start slower and finish stronger. And so you see a more even strategy, whereas the 100 meter athletes, and you saw that last night. The problem
is, you're saying that Millie Weber, even though she was, when we were watching on TV, she's catching Daphne Skippers and Tolu quite incredibly in the last 30 meters. She's still slower than she was in that second quarter.
Around the bend,
But the other ones are slowing down more.
So it's a relative thing. And your eye sees the relative gap changing. You're like, look how fast she's finishing. It's just degrees of slowing down.
So she's not accelerating over the last 30 minutes. She's actually just going faster than the rest.
Correct. And that's the same in the four and all these events. And so when it's only at about 1500 that you start seeing athletes capable of speeding up at the end.
Because they can pace themselves differently.
Yeah, and there's different fatigue. We spoke 2 days ago, I think it was, about what causes fatigue, and it's always context specific, and a lot of it has to do with the intensity. And so it's only once you get to the slower stuff that you see that classic end spurt, and that's a really interesting physiological phenomenon. So yes, the only other thing to add to that is that the IAAF have been doing this big biomechanics study, and the data yesterday afternoon finally started to drip through on Twitter. And at some point in the next week or so, there will be more of that. And then you will actually be able to superimpose the speed of Miller against the speed of Skippers and Tolu every 10 meters. And you'll see that. You'll see that Miller's slowing down, but Tolu and Skippers are really slowing down.
Really slowing down.
But she's conceded 5 meters in the first 100, and she's only making back 3 in the next 100.
One of the things that I noticed last night, and maybe it's just a casual observation, is that most of those athletes in that women's 200 meters don't seem to fit the bill as you would see a traditional sprinter. Daphne Skippers does. She's reasonably compact. She's very strong on the quads. A lot of those athletes, including Shaunae Miller-Weber, very lanky athletes, and they're almost in bolt-like, which is not a traditional... When you think about sprinters, you don't think of sprinters who look lanky. They look more like 400 meter hurdlers or 400 meter runners rather than 200 meter runners.
If you go back, like Mary Jose Perec, you would have remembered from Atlanta.
Very lanky.
Yeah. She was a bit like a Shaunae Miller physique, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
You feel like if you saw a silhouette, you wouldn't be able to tell them apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Alison Felix is quite slight, and she's been for almost a decade now one of the top 2-4 athletes in the world. So you can do it. It just shows you that size doesn't mean power. You can be very powerful and very slight. And obviously at some point, you start adding muscle that becomes negative because now you're accelerating a bigger mass, and that's takes more work.
And there's been, I mean, obviously there's been a lot of talk around these world championships around athletes doing the double. So we talked about Casa Semenya potentially going for the 15 and the 8. She only gets the bronze in the 15. Hopefully she'll get the 8 gold from a South African perspective. But the double in the sprint is the 200, 400 that Wade van Niekerk was going. He also misses that literally by one place. It seems like that double is more difficult than people properly believe, because it seems like you've had a short amount of time, short distances, you should be able to recover in time, but actually the athletes are proving it's not. There's a difference between 200 and 400, quite a lot.
Yeah, and it's exceptionally rare.
Mm.
I think Michael Johnson in 96 was the first guy to do it.
Mm.
But in fact, I think he was the second, because at the same games, Perec did it.
Mm.
But going into Atlanta, it hadn't been done before. Yeah. So that tells you a little bit about how difficult it was. In the 80s, Marita Koch was an outstanding 200 athlete.
Mm.
But, I mean, that was or better off about athletes in the 80s.
Yes.
And how you did that. But Miller and Fenikak show us how very difficult that double is to do. Mm. Part of it is, and they changed the schedule a little bit to allow it to happen. Mm. Remember, Fenikak wanted to do it, and they had to adjust it. But even with that change, Fenikak ran every single day for six days.
Yeah.
And yes, it's just a 200, and he's not maximal. But as we said in a podcast, I forget, a few days back, every single one of those efforts is actually a 2 to 3 hour day.
Yeah.
Because there's the warm-up and the cool-downs and the preparation and the mental energy and so on. So it's difficult. The 8:15, there's a lot of athletes doing that.
Yeah.
On the women's side. A couple of them in the final. And that one's a little bit more doable because they've actually got a couple of days off in between. The 2:04, there's too many athletes, too many heats, and so you can't give them the days.
I suppose when you're talking about 8 and 15, an athlete like Caster Semenya, for instance, in those first heats, even though she's running further, maybe the intensity level to get through to a semi and even to a final is less than somebody running a flat out 200, 400 on successive days. Yeah,
so the recovery profile is different.
Yeah.
And we spoke again. It's cool how I find it cool anyway how themes keep coming back because the same things are relevant to all these discussions. Is if you go down to your local gym and you find most gyms now have got these boxes, find the 60 centimeter or the 80, whatever you think is challenging. Just do 10 jumps up and down of that, and you'll feel like you're not really working in the moment. It's tough. You'll push a bead by the end of it, but you won't be. You won't be feeling like you do at the end of your park run. The next day, go and do it again, and you'll just feel like you have a puncture.
Yeah.
And so that high-intensity stuff, it's a neuromuscular component that you don't get as a distance runner. So it's completely different. Whereas Farah, for instance, and we've got the men's 5,000s tonight, he was saying that after the 10, his legs were sore. That's just muscle damage from repeat high numbers of contractions. So
the world-famous DOMS.
Exactly.
Delayed onset muscle soreness.
So everyone's going through slightly different things, but the key is how quickly can you get back to almost normal? And those 2:04 guys, they don't, because it's just too much going on.
I guess there's a lesson for the average runners out there, you know, the guys doing the park runs and the 10Ks, is it shows you when you're doing interval work, how much you have to make sure that you've always got a day of recovery before and a day of recovery afterwards. And I think even at that sort of level, I know for myself, I go and do some intervals around a track, and the next day you do feel dead, but you don't really understand why. But the effect of high-intensity exercise is good, and in fact, it makes you train. You can train hard and be faster, but you've got to remember that the effect of that, even though it's a shorter time, will actually lead to a much lower rate of recovery.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just talk a little bit about scheduling. I know we talked a little bit about the sport itself throughout these world championships and where the sport goes from here. Everybody talking about the athletics being a bit of a good description was it was a tent pole business because of Usain Bolt. Now Usain Bolt is leaving the sport. He's going to be involved in the 4x1 tonight. But then that's the end. That's the end of the Bolt era. What next? What is involved in athletics? And one of the things that we were talking about before the podcast is I was talking about the fact that last night we had two finals on track. It feels like it's very spread out for me. It feels like and then in between there's medal ceremonies. We saw things last night where literally in the first lap of the women's 3,000 meter steeplechase we had some hammer throw going on. There's something that I think, and this is just purely from a viewer's perspective, somebody needs to think about what the TV broadcast looks like to the outside world. And for me, two finals in one night doesn't seem enough. Yeah. You know, you want four. When you're moving over to the hammer throw, where the interest is probably nowhere near as much as it is in the steeplechase, should you really be doing that as a TV broadcaster? Sure. But you know, particularly on the scheduling side, for me it feels like it's very drawn out and there aren't enough highlights in the evening for people to really get excited about it, which I think is the challenge around track and field.
I suspect, and I mean, we've been in track and field meetings live in stadium. It's one of the most enjoyable live experiences because there's always something going on. But on television, there's not. There's only one thing going on, and it's the thing they're choosing to show you. So it seems to me sometimes that they don't cater for that audience well enough and think, like, what does this product actually look like on the televisions to people sitting on their couches?
Yeah.
And so that steeplechase that we just spoke about, completely crazy, some of the most dramatic stuff you'll see.
Yeah.
We didn't see it live.
Yeah.
Because we were watching hammer throw, the guy coming seventh was throwing, and then he finishes the throw, And then we get to see two replays, and then we wait for the measurement while we watch him put his tracksuit on and sip his water. And meanwhile, the athlete's missed the water jump, she's fallen, and now that's a 9-minute event.
Yeah.
It drives me nuts.
Yeah.
That you have to interrupt an event that's 9 minutes long.
And it's happened more than once.
And it's happened more than once. You miss all the moves.
Yeah.
And I don't understand. There's so much dead space, basically, between track finals and track events that you could tell the field event story in between them. You don't have to interrupt them.
Yeah.
And the problem from the field event perspective, because last night we saw a top long jump competition, one of the best long jump field event competitions you'll ever see. 5 centimeters separating first to fourth. And like right down to controversy on the second to last jump. Big stories, right? The problem with the way field events are covered is that you're cutting back and forth. So you're trying to tell a story like this, you know?
Yeah.
Imagine you're a director and you're trying to splice photographs in this order to tell a movie. It's impossible.
Yeah.
So the TV coverage doesn't do justice to either the track or the field the way they do it. I wish that they would have a meeting of, not us, but there are lots of people who share this, I'm sure, who could say, this is how you tell the story of a long jump. This is how you tell the story of a steeplechase. Yeah. Because they don't tell it right.
You just have to get hold of the guys that do NFL football.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is the most amazing television broadcast of a sport that, if you just break it down, would be fairly boring to watch, but they manage to build in and keep you excited about it all the time because they're talking about the tactics. And I agree, and I think that is the challenge for athletics. You know, let us know what you think. If you think that we're wrong and that, you know, that the schedule is just as it should be, let us know. And we think that there should be some changes to that and bring in some experts who can really talk about the excitement of track and field, because it is exciting. Once you understand it, once you understand what's happening in the steeplechase, you can watch it with a great deal of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Let's just talk briefly about that long jump. Some controversy around the number on the back of the athlete. I mean, this is bizarre in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah, so Spanovich is the second to last person to jump yesterday evening, and she puts out a big jump. The gold medal at that point was held by Brittany Reese at 7:02. And from the TV, and yes, it's difficult to judge. I don't always trust those little lines they put on, which is a good thing they do, by the way.
Yeah, it's great.
At least you've got some frame of reference.
Yeah.
But I'm not always sure it's exact. And when you've got margins of 2 centimeters between gold and silver, and then 3 to bronze and 1 more to anyway, it looks like a big jump. And then the result comes out and it's 6.91, and you're thinking, like, surely the markers are not that bad on television. But the slow motion replay, and there's a photograph doing the rounds on Twitter, shows that as Spanovich lands, obviously she's leaning back a little bit, the number on her back is flapping loose and seems to scrape the sand. Now they measure it from the board, the takeoff point, to the furthest point closest to that in the pit.
Yeah.
And so if that's cost her 10 centimeters, that's silver. If it's cost her 11 centimeters, that's gold.
Yeah.
And so it's difficult to know. I'm guessing how much does that cost her. But certainly it looks like a medal. She's not happy. I saw... she's tweeted afterwards, she tweets injustice. It's in Serbian, so I ran it through my nifty Google Translator. I don't know how accurate this is. It says, injustice in Serbia, gold is mine now and always, or something like that. So she's not happy about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, on top
I guess the IAAF will say, well, you've got to make sure your number's on right. I
mean, that's exactly what they're saying.
The chances are of that happening obviously very slim, but you know, she should have had that number pinned down at the back. And in an event like that, there's always a chance that something weird like that can happen.
Exactly. Yeah. So you've got to make sure that nothing loose. And we've seen, okay, crazy example. Blessing Okugbare is a Nigerian long jumper. She was in the final last night. I forget which diamond league it is. While she's in the air, her hairpiece falls off. And so they measure that. Because
it lands first.
Yeah. It lands furthest back. So that made it on that put track and field on the news in the United States for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
But that's an example. Like you are responsible for it, but because it's a part of the official outfit, basically, that it's a compulsory number. I don't understand why you need it at the back.
I mean, well, this is athletics, so there's a lot of rules that don't make sense.
Why do you even need the number at the back?
That's true.
It's.
I suppose so that people can see you in the crowd and they can see who it is. That's also a good thing. You can see who's jumping.
I mean, you can't read it anyway.
Yeah, maybe.
And the cameras aren't going to show you preparing for a jump from behind.
Yeah. Well, they do.
Sometimes. Famous photograph for that.
Yes.
Train of thought. Anyway, I mean, they're putting up the names. And it's the stadium announcer. It's just... Anyway, so I feel for her. If that cost her a medal, And she needed 1 centimeter extra to win a medal.
Yeah.
She needed 4 centimeters extra to get a silver medal. So.
And as you say, the TV angle isn't conclusive at all, because the actual TV camera is not exactly perpendicular to the way that she lands.
Exactly.
So when you look at it like that, it looks like she's literally just, she's hit a number, but there's no evidence to suggest that she's that number's anywhere before when she actually has landed. So.
Exactly, yeah.
Anyway, interesting, and I'm sure she maybe we'll hear more about this later on. I guess once they've leveled out the sand, they can't exactly go back and have a look at where you land. Yeah. It's not like a... Maybe they should be doing like they do on tennis. They can have a replay, and they can have a virtual line like they do tennis, and where did you land?
A Hawkeye version of long
jump. Who knows? Let's talk about finals tonight. There's a bit of excitement, a few more finals tonight than we've had, and also some excitement around the relays as well. The 100-meter hurdles for women. There's the 5,000 meters for men. That's probably the big one from a British perspective, with Mo Farah looking to do the double. We've talked ad nauseum about him and about his links. There were some stories up in The Guardian yesterday, which you were quoted on. He's looking good for the 5,000 final, no doubt.
Yeah, it's difficult to see anyone beating him. The 5,000 seems unbelievably weak to me. The Kenyans are non-existent. They managed to get a guy in as a fastest loser. Kenya had a guy in the heats who got lapped. I mean, it's unbelievable. He must have been sick. I mean, maybe he had this virus that's been going on or something. But then I looked him up, and he's only a 13-16 guy. The South African record's 13-11.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that Kenya cannot find anyone in that country who's faster than our record?
Not conspiracy theorists are working overtime.
It's crazy. So the 5,000 to me, and to some extent the 10, less so, there's a real vacuum of ability in those events. And I think it's the result of the marathon growing in wealth over the last decade or so. And I think most of the top talent, you know, it used to be that you would run the track when you finished school and you're 18, 19. And by the time you're 27, 28, then you lost your speed a little bit, you go to the marathon. And even one generation ago, that's how it went. Kenenisa Bekele stayed on track until he's done, and then they go. Gebre Selassie did it. Turgot did it. They've all done it. It seems now that you go straight to the marathon.
Yeah.
Like, why waste 10 years slogging around the track when you can go and win half a million in a marathon? So
then you have to win.
You have to win. So it's all eggs in one basket, but it's a big basket. Yeah, it's a big basket. And there's two big opportunities a year. You run a couple half marathons. There's just more money on the roads. And so the result of that is that the best Kenyan and Ethiopians are no longer on the track. And so it's much more difficult for me now to be excited about the five than it used to be. I'm going to watch tonight, and I think Farah's going to win it easy. The Ethiopians will throw what they've got at him. And it's a bit more frenetic because it's shorter, so there'll be a big group. But I think it'll go to script. Although then again, not much that these world champs has. So maybe I should say that, because then it won't go to script and it'll be more exciting. But I fully expect them to. It'll be slow. They'll build it up. The Kenyans will try something. 600 to go. Farah will be at the front, and it'll go exactly like it's gone 10 times now.
He should have recovered it. I mean, he did suffer a little bit during the heats, but he should have recovered by now. A couple of massages.
Yeah, and there's enough time. I mean, the five heats were 2 days ago, and the 10 finals were 3 days before that. They'll be fine.
So we'll see what happens in the 5,000 tonight. As Ross has said, there's no such thing as normal at these world championships. And we'll come to some of the stats on Monday when we wrap up the whole week or week and a bit of the world champs, and talk about how each of the events has got a different country winning it, which is extraordinary.
So far.
Obviously, that can change over the weekend. But there's an amazing array, a spread of nations across the gold medals.
Yeah.
The 4x1 is tonight as well. The initial heats, obviously the finals tomorrow. Usain Bolt will obviously be racing for Jamaica in the men's 4x1. Any thoughts on the 4x1? I love it. I think it's fantastic. Yeah. I know that this morning they're doing the 4x4 as well, heats.
Yeah.
They're also brilliant to watch. It's amazing. But I suppose the 4x1 is the sort of the ultimate excitement event in terms of it's the fastest guys in the world all on one track.
It's difficult to follow, though.
Yeah, it is.
If there's one thing against the 4x100 heats, it's difficult to follow because you can't see the intricacies of what's happening in the changeovers.
Yeah.
And normally what happens is they'll all cross the line but one who's dropped the baton somewhere at the 200-meter mark, and then someone else gets disqualified after the race. Yeah. So
and the pressure is huge.
So the fun about the relay is, A, it's USA Jamaica, yeah, as it has been for years. Mm. And Jamaica in the men's side have swept that. Mm. So this is, by virtue of Bolt's retirement, perhaps the USA's last chance to dethrone that Jamaican team. So that'll be interesting. There's a story in that.
Yeah.
Then there's another story in who drops the baton. Mm. There's always someone. There's always. And it's normally the US or Great Britain. Jamaica hasn't. Maybe it's their turn. But so that's interesting. Those heats are on, I think, right now. So that's worth having a look. And on the women's side, it's been a lot more even, USA, Jamaica, over the years. They've sort of exchanged it. But the US, I think, if you look at the 100s, are probably slight favorites. In Rio, one of the best stories of Rio was the Japanese relay team came second.
In the 4x1.
Yeah, and you talk about a team being more than the sum of its parts. And and if you can have a look at the changeovers, you'll see that they've clearly made an effort to optimize those. Because, I mean, you can go and look at who made the semis of the 100, and you'll see three Jamaicans, three USA, there's three Japanese guys. But on times, it doesn't work like that. Because if you can add... Well, if you can gain 0.2 seconds per change, that's half a second.
Let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of the 4x1. Who goes? Which guy goes? Who's the fastest guy? Where should he go? Why does he always? I know that most of the time it's normally the last runner is the fastest runner in the team, but not always though. How do they decide on what order they go in?
Well, the back straight allows you to, if you get it right, to have the guy run the longest distance.
Ah.
Because they have to change batons between two markings. Mm-hmm. Either side of the 100 meter, 200 meter, 300 meter mark, right? Mm-hmm. So if you get it right, you can hand over to your fastest guy at the beginning of that zone, and he can hand over at the end. And so he can actually.
So he's running number two.
Yeah, he can run number two. Any one of the first few three could run longer. Mm. The last guy is running pretty close to 100, unless he takes that baton right at the start of his changeover zone. Yeah. He might run a little bit of the bend.
So where the changeover zone is, so the changeover zone, at the end of that changeover zone, that's 100 meters between that and the finish of the race and the 100. And then in between...
No, the middle of the changeover zone is 100 meters to the finish line and to the middle of the previous changeover, previous. Right. So that's why you can, if you get the timing right, and teams, this is why they get disqualified, is they mess that up.
Yeah. Because it's a real science to go at that speed and hand over.
Yeah, because the incoming guy is, as we just said, like early in this podcast, he's slowing down a little bit.
Yeah.
And the outgoing guy is starting from a standing start.
Yes.
But if the receiver goes even a meter too soon, he leaves the incoming guy behind.
Yeah.
And then you've got this desperate situation where you just want to throw it at the guy. Yeah. You know? And so oftentimes they mess up the changeover that way. They either drop the baton or the timing's not right. And the Japanese last year... If you think, okay, it's a stereotype, but you think like Japanese precision, that was what that relay was. So they were a team that was better than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
The USA and Jamaica are always pretty much either equal to or slightly worse. And so
I always feel sorry for the there's always the one guy in those big teams that's not the big name. And I can't think of an instance now particularly, but I know that I've seen this in the past where the mistake is made by the bloke who's just in the team just for the relay, and he's got these superstars with him, and he's the guy that messes it up ruins it for everybody. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like back in the change room if you're the guy that ends up dropping the baton.
You wouldn't want to be the guy. I don't know what Jamaica will do. When Jamaica broke the world records and won most of their goals, they had a Asafa Powell running the final leg. Not Bolt. They used to put Bolt around the bend because he was a good 200-meter guy. So he had a good... Because that's another aspect to consider. Some people are good on the straight, but they can't translate it into a bend run, whereas Bolt was good at it. So you need an explosive starter. So in the woman, for instance, Tiana Bartoletta, who's a long jumper, normally starts off for the US because she's just explosive, and they reckon she's the quickest. For the Jamaicans... The guy who won the 110 hurdles is in that team, so he may be their starter.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't want to be the guy with Bolt standing in the with the home straight in his last ever run who botches it on the one before so that it never gets to him. You'll be unpopular.
Absolutely, to the whole crowd.
Exactly.
So we're watching the heats of that tonight, and then, of course, tomorrow, the final day, and on Monday we'll be doing a wrap-up of the entire week.
Good question.
Just a couple of questions have come through, Ross.
This is a cracking question, and I left it to the end so that I could think about it in between. Adam Price has asked, to which single event athlete do you think decathletes are most physiologically similar? So the decathlon ends tonight, 1,500 meters, which they all hate.
Right. Yeah.
But they do 10 events if you don't follow the sport. There's 10 events over 2 days. They do 5 on day 1, 5 on day 2. They've just finished the, they did a 400 last night. I was just catching up on that this morning.
You need to be an actuary to understand the point system.
You say, and then they award points based on performance. So in the high jump, for instance, I was watching it yesterday, every 3 centimeters earns you 27, 28 points extra. Mm. So you're accumulating points based on performance.
Yeah.
So Adam, I mean, that's such a good question. So which single event athletes? Off the top of my head, I mean, they're not similar at all to marathon runners because they do shot put and high jump. And so you're not going to... They're not similar at all to 100-meter sprinters because they've got to do 400s and they've got to be have some endurance.
Mm.
If I had to guess, I'd say 400 hurdles.
That is the athlete most like a decathlete or an heptathlete.
Yeah, yeah, that's a single event guy. Because 400 hurdles is you've got to have tremendous speed, fatigue resistance, athleticism in terms of technique of running the hurdle. And so I would say that, but it's a really good question.
Well, look, it's definitely Skippers. I mean, she was a heptathlete.
She's a heptathlete too.
I'd throw it out there and say it's more to do with the short sprints that they're most compatible, because it's not the physiology of an athlete based on fast twitch versus slow twitch muscle fibers, and therefore if you've got fast twitch muscle fibers, you can do things like throw things and jump things.
So it certainly is weighted more. You're right. It's weighted more towards the speed power events. But they do shot puts, and they do... So for instance, heptathlon, since we're talking skippers, there's a javelin throw. So you're right. That's an event that a marathon runner is not going to excel at, whereas a sprinter can. Because it's the same explosive muscle and metabolic action. So you're right. It's a sprinter. But that's why, for me... I was thinking 800, but they're not powerful enough.
No.
The 400 hurdle athletes for me are
power.
The power plus obviously tremendous speed.
So something between a 200-meter really runner and a 400-meter hurdler.
It's a really good question. Then Peter Karui, who based on your surname, I'm guessing, is in Kenya, says Mo Farah could get upset. The 3 Ethiopians are strong. They are, but I don't think strong enough. We'll see. I'll be hoping, but I don't think so.
You know, join us tomorrow. Yeah. If you're right, I'm sure you'll be on our podcast tomorrow.
We'll give you a tip of the hat.
We'll see how they do tonight. It's going to be an interesting night tonight. Some good finals tonight. And, of course, the big events and finals and closing ceremony tomorrow. We'd like to obviously hear from you on our Twitter. It's Ross is on Science of Sport. And, of course, Runners World SA is our Twitter handle on Runners World South Africa. And I'm on Mike Finch SA. So please feel free to tweet us. I know that Ross's Twitter feed has been very active this week, and very interested to hear some very vociferous debates going on Twitter at the moment around these World Championships. But I'm sure more will continue over these next couple of days. Thanks so much for joining us, Ross. We'll be back tomorrow around about 11 o'clock tomorrow, South African time, 10 o'clock in the morning, UK time. And feel free to send us any questions or comments between now and then. Cheers for now.
Ciao.